To episode 15 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is January 8th, 2012. I'm Matthew Furlough, and this is my brosif and co-host, James Furlough.
Hey!
Sup?
Hi.
I was expecting a little bit more.
I know. Well, I make this stuff up on the fly, so sometimes it's, you know.
We can't expect too much.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't plan ahead like me.
I don't spend all week, you know, planning. Maybe I should. I don't know.
We'll talk about it. We'll take it offline.
Okay.
This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, the soap opera that is corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and the technology they're developing. And this is our disclosure.
So, I work for HP, however, I do not represent HP or any of their opinions, and I should always say I, and if I say we, I meant to say I. How's that mic going?
I have a serious question. Can All you right. hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay.
They were just getting some feedback. It was like you were hitting your shirt or something.
Oh, okay. Sorry, audience, you shouldn't have to deal with this junk.
But. So he's messing with his mic right now, in case you really can't tell.
All right, we got this. For those of you not watching the video, anyways, the disclosure.
Oh, yeah, so I work for HP, but I don't represent them. There you go.
All right, cool. I appreciate that really quick. You can follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Matthew D. Furlough.
And mine is at James Furlough.
And the show's is at Furlough Bros. You can also go to our website, furloughbros.com. You can go to our Facebook page or our Google Plus page. And those are both furloughbros.com. And, yeah, check us out. Follow us, like us, plus one us, retweet us. Any of that sort of crazy stuff that you guys want to do.
Yeah.
Well, you can also go to my YouTube channel where we do our weekly amazing little short. If you want to get a... Get a small morsel tasting.
That's right. So. Cool. So, let's talk some tech.
Yeah, this is...
I know it's the week before CES, so you would think it would be a dull week where nothing was going on and everyone was waiting, but that's not the case.
That is not the case. I was actually a little bit disappointed this week by the lack of pre-CES news. But, you know, everyone's kind of keeping a tight lid on it, getting ready for the week coming up. So I'm actually really looking forward to next week. But this is going to be a good show, too.
Yeah, definitely.
So do you want me to get us going out the gate?
I do. Go ahead.
So this is totally not consumer electronics show related. Apple is planning a special media event for... few weeks from now, I don't remember the precise date.
Later this month.
Yeah, thank you. Later this month. Yeah, they. Thank you, man. Sure, glad you're paying attention to my articles. So they're going to be going later this month. They haven't said what it's about, but there's a lot of mumbling because obviously there's some big products that Apple will classically release. It's going to be in New York, which is a little bit different. They usually pick a venue close to home when they make big announcements. Occasionally, when they make a little bit smaller announcements, that's when they'll venture to the other coast. And so the big question is, what are they going to be talking about? Or at least that was the big question throughout the week. So we do have a follow-up article. Number one, Apple basically just threw down the gauntlet and was like, it's not going to be about the iPad, because they knew that that was what everybody was going to think it was. They don't usually come out and just tell you what it isn't about, but they were really explicit because they didn't want that to get into the the news cycle and have people like you and I talking about the iPad 3 and then have it seem like it was delayed when it was just anxious bloggers. So they quotes that one right out the gate.
This reminds me, before I got engaged and was just dating Jessie, and she wanted to get engaged, but I literally didn't have the money for a ring yet. But I would want to take her out to dinner or something, and I would say, hey, I'd like to go out to dinner with you. And I would literally have to follow it up with, I am not going to propose to you tonight. because she would, because I had this, it happened a couple times before I learned my lesson. I'm a little slow. Where I would plan this night, we would have fun, go out, you know, have a really good time, and we get done, and she'd be sad. I'd be like, what did I, felt like I did a good job here. and she'd totally be like, well, honestly, I thought you were going to propose to me tonight, and you didn't, so I'm disappointed. Aww. And so it's just like this huge mismatch of expectations where, you know, she thought it was going to be the greatest night of her life. I was like, it's just going to be good. I'm not shooting for great yet. And so, so I totally understand what Apple's doing, because if you don't do that, everyone's going to be like, what the heck? I thought you were going to come out with the iTV or the iPad 3 or, you know, some hardware thing. And they're like, no.
Yeah, I thought you were going to announce Steve Jobs is still alive. Like, no.
Yeah.
You know, that's
he's frozen right next to Walt Disney right now.
Exactly. You know, that crossed my mind for some reason earlier this week. I completely agree with you. That's something that Apple's definitely been accused of being poor at in the last. You know, they got so good at controlling the news and with the controlled leaks and everything, and getting a lot of free advertising, that when that started to bite them in the butt, and they would, you know, they'd be sitting there and they wouldn't exceed and pass everybody's expectations, even when everybody's expectations were ridiculous. Everyone would get upset. And so I think it's a move to try to handle expectations better, which I think is wise.
Always a good thing.
Yeah. And so basically what they've come out and they've, I guess TechCrunch has got a little bit more news, and I've read this in a couple different places, so I don't know where this leak is coming from, but I'm pretty sure this is what it's related to, but they're talking about the idea of it's going to be related to iBooks publishing and iTextbooks is what they're saying this one's going to be all about.
Cool. I don't know what you could really announce there that would be super interesting, but
Because I've read in a couple places, I don't know if this is just people's theories or if there's any truth to this, but you know, right now iBooks isn't used for textbooks. It's really used primarily for leisurely reading, which is great.
Right. That makes sense.
But I think schools really want a powerful textbook platform. And so I think what you might see is just a new software update where iBooks, you know, they introduce better tools for taking notes and marking up your books and stuff like that. And push forward to try to get a couple more interactive textbooks so that, you know, a bunch of schools are buying tons and tons of iPads. I'm sure they want something that is, you know, they want to have something in the classroom that takes advantage of the platform. You know, we're spending all this money on it. Give us something that makes it worth our while. So that's my guess is what it's about.
Cool. We'll see.
Yeah. But
later this month, right?
Later this month, yeah. So, you know, that'll be interesting. Obviously, what's going to be crazy is that it won't pale in comparison to CES, even though I think CES would be arguably a bigger deal. But, you know, guess what we're talking about this week and not talking about this week? Talking about iBooks and not CES.
Well, we'll see. We got to get there. There'll be some cool stuff, I'm sure.
Like I said, I'm actually very excited about it. So, and then keep on. This is sort of an Apple heavy week for me, so we'll just keep on rolling with Apple news.
But don't worry, devoted listeners. I make sure to counterbalance him.
Yeah, it's true. So Apple had this really cute commercial. We'll link it on the on our webpage. You'll be able to watch the actual commercial. But it's basically them showing off the iPhone 4S. They're taking pictures of this young actress and, you know, just showing off all the cool features that the new iOS 5 can do with the better camera on the iPhone 4S. You know, pretty... It was actually one of the few commercials that they did that didn't involve Siri when advertising the iPhone 4S. And, you know, Apple's been sort of having a problem with Samsung stealing some of their design stuff. If you're following the patent wars at all, Apple's actually doing pretty well battling Samsung, claiming that they're just ripping off their intellectual property, they're out and out copying them. So Samsung, as a way to show that they're not in any way copying them, released a commercial that has a similar vibe, advertising a tablet iPad lookalike using the same young female actress.
Wow, that takes it to a whole new level. Nice.
Yeah, it's just as like you sit there and you go like, what are you guys doing here? I can't even figure it out. It just is. I don't know, James. They're really trying to push this idea that they're not copying Apple, that they're not, they want to sit in court and claim that they're not trying to sell really expensive knockoffs of Apple products, but it's so clear that what the people who are buying their products want and what their company is trying to do is create Apple knockoff products. I don't know. It's an interesting dilemma. Especially if your devices are selling. If they're selling, because that's what people want, you really don't want to mess with the magic, even if that is just pretty blatant copying.
Weird. I mean, honestly, it's that fine line, right, of... Yeah, you don't want a blatant copy, but it's okay to take design ideas and design cues since clearly they're working. I think there's a line, and they're probably crossing it on... Well, according to the courts, they are crossing it on multiple fronts. But I think in the long run, I don't know if that's going to work for them, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Hey?
Hey, man, if it pays bills.
Yeah, exactly. So now there is one company that should do a little bit more copying and is choosing... not to at all. And all I have to say is it has begun. Those of you who are astute listeners will remember that last week we gave some predictions regarding the company RIM, our Canadian friends. Matthew, I think at the very least, you're going to be right. Because the latest rumor mills, is it rumors? I think it's actually happening. Is that our co-CEO, who are also... You know, whatever. There was supposed to be a joke right there, and it totally fell flat. I was going to say, like, we're also, like, bro-sos, and it just didn't work. I will leave that to you.
And forgive it.
thank you. I appreciate that. So anyways, these guys, who are co-CEOs, they hold significant board titles, or at least they used to, because they are going to be giving those up. Lazardus and... Vasilili?
I know.
Sorry, guys.
Lazardus is always the one that embarrasses himself, so you know his name. It's Jim Balsillie. Yeah, him, that one. I never know his name.
Balsillie is what it looks like, but
yeah.
That may not be right. Anyways, they are reportedly going to be stepping down from their director's spots. So, and this is my opinion. I mean, everyone who's... Not just my opinion, it's everyone's opinion who said this is like, yeah, that's good, it's not enough, you got to keep going. And so I think, like I said, it has begun. This is the end of their reign. Clearly they're still CEOs, but I think, like you have said, not for long, and I'm still in it for, you know, they will not exist in the same structure by the end of the year, because it took them all of a week to...
yeah.
To do this. So there's still 51 of them to go. A lot can happen. But anyways, that's RIM, man. They are. Yeah. It has begun.
Yeah, the Motley Fools actually had a article I was going to talk about that basically they took it a step further and said that this is entirely about them positioning themselves to become takeover bait. They want somebody to buy them, and so they're going to start moving around leadership and setting themselves up so that somebody who's a little bit better to handle a transition of that sort will be in place. So yeah. Well, I'm like you said, we're almost guaranteed that I'll be right about them stepping down as CEOs, but we'll see about them about the company being around, because that's clearly the goal at this point. It's not, you know, at least to the Motley Fool, it's that's the goal, not to try to save the company.
So. Well, I would agree. You know, I'm not necessarily smart enough to know the ins and outs of, you know, these movements or what set them up for this, but it's just kind of something that they got to do, or what's going to happen. They can't survive on their current track, and doing what they're doing is not enough, not even close.
Right.
But they'll get there. Another company had another big change of leadership this week. I like the very first sentence because it's a pun. The search is over. Yahoo has a new CEO. I like it. It is PayPal's president, Scott Thompson. So he used to work for my new boss, Meg Whitman, because she was CEO of eBay, who owns PayPal. And so he is going to be taking over Yahoo now. And, yeah, good luck, Scott.
I saw this awesome picture on Reddit. I didn't even think to click on it, but one of the higher ups got his picture taken with meeting Scott Thompson, and he got Scott Thompson a gift. It was Yahoo. It was a Yahoo for Dummies. So
nice.
You know, just trying to help out.
It's good. It's interesting. One of the things they asked him was, you know, what is Yahoo's competitive advantage? And so, again, a competitive advantage is something where you are good at something more than anybody else in the world.
Right.
You know, Google's competitive advantage is supposedly search. They do it faster and more comprehensive and more relevant than anybody else. You know, that's their competitive advantage. And the question that they kept asking Carol Bartz, the previous CEO of Yahoo, is, well, what do you think Yahoo's competitive advantage is? You know, kind of like, you know nothing about the company other than what everyone else knows. What do you think? And so his answer was that it is data, which I was like, okay, interesting. So in it he says, Yahoo is a tech company. Where does he say it? He says, it's both excellent technology and content, not one or the other. And he says, Yahoo's core business is to provide experiences that engage users. Everything flows from that. And what he's saying is they will be able to provide those experiences from all of the data that Yahoo has collected. I'm honestly not 100% sure like what kind of data he's referring to. You know, he says data is a very hard concept to understand unless you are in the middle of it. There's tremendous value if you can organize and integrate data at the scale Yahoo has it. And he talks about how they have 700 million users, and they are going to be able to use that to deliver more value to advertisers and, you know, to the users themselves. And it's through Yahoo's data. I personally, it's like, why don't you spend a couple more months on the job and then report back?
Right.
You know, you might want to refine that answer, because I think every company's, you know, data is important. You know, that is Google's whole thing, right? It's like they meticulously collect and analyze data to the point where artists hate working there because they're like, you should make this line 5 pixels instead of 3 pixels because according to our data, it's better.
Right.
Like, great, but I made it using 3 because it's prettier.
Right.
And so, so you know, we'll see. But, hey, cool. Yahoo's on to its next step. This guy sounds a little bit more down to earth than Carol Bartz, who would swear up a storm and, you know, pick fights with people. But cool. I'd love to see Yahoo get back into the mix and, you know, get competitive again in whatever form that happens to be.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. It'll be fun to follow.
Yeah, because they need something, because they're hurting right now.
Right.
They're still a big company. It's not like they're dying. They're not RIM, but they're hurting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're a bit like AOL, I think, where it's like they found a plateau. But the problem with plateaus is, you know, you never stop moving forward. You either go up or you go down. So do you move up from here and you get better, or do you start to crash? And I always get nervous when big websites view themselves as media companies, or, you know, whatever their core thing is it's not just technology, because it doesn't allow them to evolve. And, you know, as a content company, there's other content companies out there. The only thing that they might be able to do is, you know, start a new station, or, you know, start a new network and get onto the Apple or Google TV bandwagon. You know, that could be pretty huge, but we'll see what they do. We'll see how they handle it.
Yeah, totally. Oh, it's still my turn. Wow, I guess I front-loaded all my articles, didn't I? So this one was interesting, and it was a friend of mine who I believe is also a listener, so we'll see if he notices. I won't say anything and see if he responds back. but he was pretty excited about this, and it's from Roku. They have figured out a way to take the Roku box, which is an online streaming player, and literally shrink it down to a thumb drive that fits into the back of your television via the HDMI port.
Whoa.
Yeah, and so it literally inside of it has the Wi-Fi unit and the, you know, the computer itself that runs everything. And so and there's new HDMI ports out there that have something called MHL, which is mobile high definition link. Basically what that means is it allow it to do two things. A, it feeds it power, which is cool, because it literally it's like a flash drive stick in that regard. You don't have to plug it in. And B, and this one's super cool, you can use your TV's remote to control the Roku box.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you don't need yet another remote. Everything works through that single television remote. And so, once again, you can stream YouTube, Hulu, Netflix, whatever other content partners they have. I don't know, because I don't have a Roku box. but it's pretty cool. And they haven't announced pricing yet, but it should be somewhere in the range of $50 to $100.
Nice. So, that's actually a pretty big deal, because, in my opinion, because, you know, HDMI, one of the big changes that HDMI brought to the table was more than just high definition. It's kind of thought as the high definition king, but it was one of the first really universal audio and visual compound ports. It does both. Which it's like, you know, for the longest time, you had like your RCL cables did
RCA, RCL.
Yeah,
RCA?
the red, yellow, white cables. Are those RCAs? But, okay.
I think they're component, but you know, whatever. You know what you're talking about.
Right. Well, and the whole idea was that it was component. You'd have three wires that were literally like glued together, and you had your two audio channels and your one. And your visual channel, and the question becomes, why have them in three separate places? Why not just have one port? And then, you know, contrasting that to the universal serial bus, your USB port, where you had a 5-volt power supply, you had a logic level power supply coming out, you've got data coming in and out, so it's not just a passive, you know, for the longest time, video was just thought of as we're just going to output video, and it's just one stream of data. There's no data coming back. There's no data. There's just data going out, and it's only video. We don't have other things. But you know, as technology evolves, it's becoming more and more clear that there's a huge advantage to having all sorts of dynamic cables that do power, that do that send data back and forth, that have different data lines so you can do simultaneous data, or really, really high density data channels like what you have with Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt, you know, being this thing, and this there was a new patent this week that that Apple released talking about having Thunderbolt plug into your directly into your iPhone, iPods, gives you a whole lot more current and voltage so that you can power them quicker, recharge them quicker, and a tremendous amount more data. And so you sit there and you go, you can do these huge things. So I say all this because this MHL idea seems really awesome, because there are a lot more of these types of devices coming out where you don't want to have to plug it into your wall. You just want power to come through your TV. You don't want it to, you want to be able to talk to the device directly through the TV. And so there's all sorts of neat things that you can do with that. And Roku's such a big name right now. It's definitely a good one to get on this bandwagon, because it'll really, people will buy these, you know, they'll buy their TV set and go, and it'll be like, well, you can get the normal HDTV, or you can get this TV with MHL for an extra $25. And people will be like, why would I get the more expensive TV? What does that give me? And instead of it just being a laundry list of cool technical specs, there's actual, you know, well, here's a huge service that you can get that's easier to use. It's instantly integrated into your TV. All you do is plug it in. So that's neat. That's cool to hear coming down the pipe.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The only downside right now, which won't last forever, is that it's like a brand new thing, and the first TVs supporting that MHL came out in August, so there's not a ton of them on the market, but that will clearly change this year. But
right. Well, yeah, cool. Yeah. Hey, especially, I'm sure everybody will build it into their TVs. You know, there's never a lack of ports on TVs. Well, that's not true, but it either goes one of two ways with TVs, isn't it? It's like, either there's so many, you're like, what is the point of all of these little ports? Or there's so few that you're like, I can't even play two video games at the same time. What are you guys doing?
Nice.
But, yeah, that'll be fun to watch, especially over the next year. So, talking about things that'll be fun to watch, people are getting finally starting to talk about the Google Nexus tablet. This, you know, we talked about it as we thought it was the big thing Google was going to be doing this year, so the question is, what's it going to be like? And I had kind of made the assumption, And the more and more I think about it, the more and more I realize it is just an assumption that they were going to try to target the iPad. That the whole idea was, we'd make this great device that can go toe-to-toe with the iPad. This first articles that I'm reading, though, are saying, once again, I don't know if they know anything more than me, if they're just, this is their best guess, but what people are starting to assume is that it's going to be a 7-inch tablet running the latest Android for $200. The whole idea of it is to compete against Amazon's Kindle Fire.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. What? Just any reason why? They just think it will.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is I'm starting to realize that we're all kind of coming out the gate. But it is basically. This article is saying that, it's assumed that it's going to compete against the Apple iPad. Sources from Google upstream supply chain believe that Google, instead of Apple, may actually be targeting Amazon's 7-inch Kindle Fire as its major competitor. So basically, it's the upstream suppliers. It's the guys that are actually building the screens are saying, yeah, they're not asking for 10-inch screens. They're asking for 7-inch screens.
They've got to be going for a price point then.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Because I think it's dumb. I think it's,
All right.
And I don't know. I always come back to, I think the 7-inch is, I think it's a small market. I don't think there's a ton of people who want a 7-inch tablet. I think I just don't think they sell very well. I think people would prefer a 10-inch tablet. And it's unfortunate because, you know, Nexus is always, I guess what bothers me about it is the Nexus is always about this is the absolute cool stuff you can do with Google technology. And so the idea of them to come out and have it on a small screen just seems really weak. seems unexciting, doesn't seem very innovative. And there's just so many limitations that come with that. You know, power, how long the battery is going to last, what different cool antennas you can pack into it, all sorts of stuff. It becomes, you know, from an engineering perspective, it might be more impressive, but from an end user perspective, it's pretty uninspiring. And the thing with the Nexus, and that gets me, is that I don't think the goal has ever been, I know that the goal has never been to hit mass market and just make, you know, sell a billion devices. It's not to compete, you know, hugely. The only reason I can think that they'd be doing this is because they're actually afraid of the Amazon Kindle Fire, because it's, you know, because like we've talked about on the show before, you know, the whole idea that it's sort of Android getting away from Google. They're losing the reins on their own horse. And I wonder if this is going to be their attempt to try to give direction to their partners.
So we'll have to, how do I want to say it? I actually got to play with a Kindle, and I'm going to wait until the end to talk about that experience. You know, and then to compare that to also playing with an iPad last week. And I'll be able to talk about some of those differences. And
I don't know. I hate to do this to you, but I know we have a schedule, but this seems like a perfect time to bring it up.
All right. Sounds good. So I got to play with the Kindle this weekend. So I had a couple observations. And I'll be honest, I only got to play with it for like a half hour. That was it. In that time, I, you know, opened up as many apps as I could, tried some stuff out, you know, wanted to see what it was like. It runs Flash. I think we already knew that. But I tested it. I played one of our podcasts, and
oh, nice.
And it worked just fine. So I was like, all right, I like the device, I guess. can't do that on an iPad. You actually have to click on the download link, and then it'll literally download it and then play it in a separate web page. I felt like it. Obviously, maybe not obviously, it clearly did not have the same fluidity of an iPad, or an iPhone for that matter. You can feel that there's a lag, you can feel it thinking. It's not bad, it's definitely usable. I thought it was interesting, he had downloaded a magazine, and it was just like basically like it was a PDF of the magazine. And then you had to zoom in on each piece. It was not even kind of closely formatted.
Wow.
To it. And the other thing that was kind of weird is when you would double tap on a section on an iOS device, it zooms straight into that paragraph, you know, like perfectly
right.
What you would expect. Not even close on this one. It would zoom into the right focal point, but it wouldn't be centered. And so you'd still have to tap it again and try to move it. And
oh, that would be unbearable to me.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But the watching movies, it's, you know, it's a 7-inch screen, but it wasn't bad by any means. You know, I enjoy watching movies on my iPhone, so it was like, man, this is good.
Yeah.
It works. I thought that was cool. Reading books, you know, obviously Amazon has figured out the whole book reader thing. It looks almost exactly like iBooks or the Kindle for iPad. You know, they've done a good job of making it consistent across all devices. And so it looks good. It works well. If you're not going to read for more than like 40 minutes at a time, yeah, I would get a Fire over a Touch any day of the week. Definitely. It was pretty small form factor. I mean, it didn't feel, it was inside, this one was inside of a case, so I couldn't like, you know, try to flex it or anything. but it felt fine. You know, I didn't feel like I was going to break it or anything. There's a few phones that I've picked up, you know, Android phones that just, you know, they feel like plastic, and you're like, oh gosh,
they feel flimsy.
I gotta be, yeah, of course. I also go, I gotta be careful with my iPhone because it's made of glass. So,
you know,
whatever.
Sure.
And let's see, what else did I do? I tweeted from it, from the guy's account, saying that I was awesome because I figured, why not?
Nice.
Let's see. I think those are all the big things. I also played, what's that thing called? Fruit Ninja a little bit to see what the swiping action was like. It's much better than the Kinect Fruit Ninja because that one just is kind of weird overall. But I thought it was fine. I thought it was good. You can play the game. It wasn't any time where I was like, I totally swiped that fruit. Why didn't it register it? No, it was cool. It's just a little bit, it's not as smooth, I guess, which everyone says. And so if I were to get a Kindle Touch or a Kindle Fire, if I were deciding between those two, I would definitely go with the Fire, no doubt in my mind on that one. I don't read a ton anyway, so, you know. I don't spend like hours reading, I guess. If you're one of those people, okay, maybe not. It was actually talking to him, it was like, yeah, he's like, my sister has a Kindle Touch. It's like, and it's horrible. She has to turn on a light to read. It's like, so you can't really read in bed. It's like, huh, interesting. That's kind of like, you know, that's what everyone likes about it. And so, but he said he liked it. He goes, it was a good device. And, you know, he's like, honestly, you know, if money wasn't an issue, yeah, I probably would get an iPad just because it can do, well, he's like, it can do all of that plus more. It's got a bigger screen, of course. But he also didn't feel like, he goes, ah, oh, I wish I had an iPad because I could be able to do this rather than that. He's just like, it just tends to do things a little bit better.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, at some point, you know, what's the difference between an iMac and a you know, I was going to pick on HP, but, you know, a Dell desktop. You know, what's the difference between those two devices? Well, they run the same programs. They do a lot of the same things. You know, for most users, why get one over the other? Well, because one does it better than the other. You know, that, and that's the, you know, and whichever way you want to look at it, you know, that's usually, you know, whether you're or not you're a fan of a Windows machine or an Apple machine, you know, ultimately, that's why you pick one over the other. So I guess,
we'll see. I mean, the question is it $300 better?
Yeah. Well, you know,
I don't know.
Well, and I think over time we'll see whether that's true or not of the Kindle Fire. Now, so the big question is it $100? Is the iPad $100 better? Because,
well, so here's the thing that I guess I forgot to throw out, is that he got an Amazon Prime account to go with it, $80 a year.
Right. Now what's,
so that's one of those hidden costs if you decide to go that route. You don't have to, but what that gives you is access to all their streaming videos. It gives you access to storing all of your music on the cloud. And, you know, otherwise all you get is like 5 gigs for storing music. All you get, that's probably plenty for me. but you get access to things that that you wouldn't otherwise. And Amazon very much plays the, because it comes with like an 8 gig hard drive, and 2 gigs of which are the operating system.
Oh, geez.
So they very much play up the whole store all your stuff on the cloud and stream it. That's a big deal to their value proposition, because there's no SD card slot. And maybe you can buy bigger versions. Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think the Apple model's working pretty well for that whole, you know, local versus cloud-based storage. So I don't know. I think.
It's cool. It was genuinely cool. I could have easily played with it for, you know, all day. It could be a secondary device for me, and it would be totally fun. I guess the big difference is, an iPad, I don't just go, you know, I go, yeah, duh, it could be a secondary device, no problem. Could I make it a primary device? And I start to think, what kind of productivity apps could I use on an iPad? You know, could it really replace everything? And after playing the Kindle, I'd be like, no, I definitely would still need a computer.
Yeah.
That's actually my answer with an iPad, too. I just don't say it quite as firmly.
Yeah, I we've had this conversation. You always say, I think I would need a computer. You know, you can come up with a couple things, and I guess for me that's like, you know, I haven't used one. I really got to go find somebody that has one, because I'd love to try it out. Because, you know, my test is always, I go to different websites, I try out different websites, and just, when I type stuff, I see how easy it is at typing, and I find that typing on the iPad is really easy. I find that I love that it's the right size for as a browser. You know, I find those sorts of things, and
I found the, you know, typing on it was easy. It was what you would expect it to do. You know, obviously Android uses a little bit different system, and once I figured out all that stuff, I actually really like that the Android keyboard. What did they have? Maybe not. I was going to say, I like that they had their period on the same key, but that's not the one. There was one where they had that, you know, thing on the first front page. Maybe it was the apostrophe. I don't remember anymore. But it was one of those where I went, oh, cool, I don't have to press a special button to try to, you know, add an apostrophe. Even though the iPad, they're just like, just keep typing and it'll fill it in automatically, which it does 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was cool. I liked it. I could buy one. I would not feel, you know, I'd be like, yeah, totally, would do it. I would not have bought an HP touchpad. I would not have wasted the $100 on that. But I would definitely, I could spend $200 on a touch, no problem.
Hmm. Or interesting.
A Kindle Fire, sorry.
That's, you know, that's interesting. And, you know, and if that's the case, if that's what Google's seeing, then maybe they do really want to bolster that market line. Maybe they think that that's their, you know, it's possible that Google looks at that 7-inch low-cost tablet area and says there's a gap there. People want devices in that range, and Android could fill that niche because Apple's not filling it right now.
The other thing, speaking of, you know, what you were saying there, that he said that was kind of weird, and it just could be he didn't understand it, but think about the type of people who are buying these devices. You know, they're not going to be spending thousands of dollars because they're not tech, you know, nerds like us. But he was like, he owns an Android phone that he has a bunch of apps on, some paid. He's like, I don't think I can put them on my Fire. He goes, I have to literally repurchase them because it's a different store and, you know, and re-download stuff. He's like, it doesn't, the only thing that literally syncs for him are the Kindle books because it's using the same app and Amazon manages all that stuff on the apps. It's like, other than that, I have to re-download, refind, repay for my apps and stuff. And he's like, that's a little weird. I was like, oh, I guess that's what happens when you have different stores and stuff like that. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. Something that can be overcome, but definitely there's some...
Yeah, you know, that's what was it this week they were talking about? The iPad just passed 3 billion downloads, and the Android tablet market still, you know, less than a billion. It's just, you know, I think that's common within the Android ecosystem. You know, lack of mobility is actually that is the fragmentation problem that everybody talks about. And I think as more people get more and more devices, I think they're going to become more aware of that fragmentation, and it's going to become more frustrating. It's something that Google really needs to focus on and, you know, encourage solutions for. You know, because that can be taken care of on behalf of the third party, you know, of the app developers. You can build ways to, you know, to sync data and do stuff like that. It's harder and it's not nearly as elegant, but you can make life easier on your users, and I think that that's of value to the ecosystem. And I think that's something that Google can encourage sincerely, since clearly they don't want to do it internally. They don't want to manage all that stuff on their own. And I think that, you know, if you're developing for the Android and you're not helping your customers out in that facet, you're really cruising for a bruising, you know, a long term, I think.
Yeah. It's cool. I still get one.
Well, you know, that's important. Speaking of tablets and getting bogged down by a fragmented ecosystem.
Nice one.
Thank you. InfoWorld had an interesting article that I thought played right into the conversation we had last week in regards to the future of Windows 8. And I'm just going to read the title for you and the subtitle, just word for word. Windows 8, bogged down by baggage. Microsoft trumpets Windows 8 refresh reset as a feature, but actually reveals bloated Windows 7 legacy code it's carting around. They're talking about, you know, one of the things that this article talks about the idea that, you know, with an OS, you sometimes have to restart your OS. Things get slowed down, bogged down, and there's a problem. Well, they basically have introduced that for Windows, a way of quickly restarting Windows so that you never have to turn it off. The whole idea is you don't want to have to turn it off all the time. So they want a quick way when things do jam up, as they will do with any operating system, they want a quick way to turn it off and bring it all back on. And what this article is basically saying is that it's actually really pointing out the huge issue that Windows is going to have with Windows 8 and the problem of having the entire legacy of Windows, you know, a couple decades of Windows behind it. And so I thought that this article made a really compelling case for why Windows 8 is going to struggle, especially in the new form factor and everything. And the one thing that they never brought up in the entire article, and it makes me feel like I've missed something, like Apple or like Microsoft announced that they weren't going to be making the Metro version of Windows 8, because nobody brings up the fact that there's going to be two Windows operating system, one for Intel and one for AMD and ARM-based chips.
Oh, really? Right. Wait, is that always the case, or?
No, so, well,
I don't understand, I guess.
Correction. So basically, you're right, because AMD makes a chip that Windows can run on, but there is going to be an ARM-based chip, which currently you can't run Windows kernel on. They're
correct.
Going to rewrite the kernel so that Windows 8 can operate on it. The only thing is it's not going to have any of the Windows legacy code. It will not be reverse compatible. You'll make an operating system, or you'll make a program in Silverlight, you'll put it onto Windows 8, and it can run on either operating system, but like, you know, in today's, with Windows 7, you can put an a virtual machine onto your computer that will run a virtual machine that will run a virtual machine that will run DOS, and you can run DOS programs, and the registry will be able to hold it all the way up and everything. There's this huge reverse compatibility that Windows has, and it's really impressive, and they're getting rid of all of that for the Metro version. And I think that one of the things that we're going to really see with Windows 8, and people are really concerned about this, is that I do not think Windows 8 is going to perform well on Intel tablets and computers, laptops.
Got it. Because it has all of the legacy code. Okay.
Yeah. I think that the Windows Metro 8 is going to be an awesome operating system. I think it's going to run smooth, it's going to have a neat UI, it's going to run all the applications that you want it to, and Windows is going to build all of their major productivity applications to run in that, I believe. I'd be shocked if they didn't. And I think it's just going to have this one operating system that works great, and then this other one that works horribly, and is going to get a lot of bad press, even though it's the same operating system, quote-unquote. And I think the future of Windows, I'm so excited to see what happens with Windows this year because of what they're doing within Windows 8. There's a path that's going to diverge in the woods, and they're going to have to choose whether to take the one, you know, less traveled or not. And I think that people are going to push them in the direction of taking the one less traveled, and I think it's going to be good for Microsoft.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. When is it? So the beta's already out, right?
No, the beta's not out. It's the developer build is out.
Okay.
Because
do you know when the beta's due?
It's middle of the year. I believe it's like July or June.
Okay.
And so for anybody who's... We've never talked about this before, but I think it's an interesting thing to pay attention to. That the beta is not actually a beta. It's an advertising campaign. It's the whole idea is they release this massive beta, they get, you know, a million people to try it out for free, people who are really enthusiastic and excited, but the operating system is 98% done. The feedback that they get is on the final 2%. If you actually wanted to make a difference, you had to be part of the developer build. That's the more traditional beta, where you actually can affect the final product. Whereas nowadays, it's, you know, the final product is, or the beta launch is almost the final product. It just is a great way to get, you know, motivated people to try it out. So, yeah, but that should be middle of the year, and then they're thinking, I think it's like September they're aiming to have the full OS be released.
Huh. All right. Cool. Then HP, let's see, when will I get it? In like 2 years?
We like
to, HP likes to adopt the new operating system right before they come out with the next operating system. So when Microsoft announced Windows 8, that was when HP finally finished their testing and said, you can now use Windows 7. It's like, cool. I don't want Windows 7 now. That's old. But no, it's cool. That's what they got. They got security stuff, and we got to make sure all of our apps work. As you could imagine, there are a couple of programs that HP depends on daily that they need to make sure that run on Windows 7. Of course, there's another side of me that's like, okay, you run the up program. It doesn't work. Now what?
Right. I love the fact that you guys push it like crazy for you guys. Sorry. I love the fact that HP pushes it like crazy for the consumer. And internally, you're like, shh, we don't want to use that yet.
Well, you know, it's got security stuff.
I was going to say, it makes sense. I think it's funny.
Right.
Yeah.
I would agree.
So, that's Windows 8. So, Windows 8 is going to be a problem, but I do believe it's for Intel and not Microsoft as a whole. Anyways, my next article is just going to be chiming in that I love being right, and room CEOs are going to be having problems this year, but we already covered that, so.
You are still right.
Yes.
So I would like to talk about this cool company that I was reading about that I probably cannot pronounce their name because I'm bad at this stuff. If we want to go far, we need to work on our pronunciations. It is Piazza. P-I-A-Z-Z-A. This particular article is talking about how they got like $6 million in a Series A, which brings them up to a total of $7.5 million. But here's what they do, which is what's cool. They are you could call it a social network in the loosest terms, a social network for colleges. They allow students to come together with teachers and right now it's a Q&A type of thing where they have an assignment or a test or something they were studying in class. They can post to, like, think of it as like a message board, either anonymously or with their name, saying, hey, I had a question about, you know, this test number, and people can reply and they can do a conversation. And it's a way for teachers to, you know, interact and other students to interact. It's a more highly structured, you know, forum. And, you know, what they go on to talk about is, like, there's a whole, like, industry for this. You know, I think Blackboard is the classic. That's the 800-pound gorilla right now. You know, most institutions. Did you guys have Blackboard at your school?
Yeah.
Did you guys use it much?
Oh, every year the teacher announced that we were going to be using it. Every year by the third week we were using whatever system that they had been using before that actually worked.
Got it.
Blackboard, I thought, was atrocious.
The only thing that we used Blackboard for was to, like, turn in homework assignments sometimes. Or, like, they would most of the time it would be they would post documents and we would go there and download them. Stuff like that. I think there was one teacher who was like, oh, I'll give you back your tests via Blackboard. That was it. Now, when I went to grad school, they actually had their own system where they hired a guy, full-time IT guy, who wrote the entire system and then managed it. And so it was a totally different system. Think of it like Blackboard, a little bit better in some ways, a little bit more felt homemade in other ways. But it worked really well. And the professors did actually use that very regularly to hand out assignments, grade tests, and stuff like that. But these are people who, like, are totally, you know, they're getting after it, saying there is a way for us to do better in this space, which I totally agree, because, like, Facebook, maybe, I guess you could set up a Facebook group for classes and then share questions and stuff. But their way of doing it where you can potentially do, you know, anonymously, and it's set up very question and answer. You could probably post stuff on there. I don't know. But it's just to help, you know, group studying. I actually wrote my own article on my blog, nice. OutsideTheRatRace.com, and I wrote it, let's see, of October of this year, and it was titled How I Would Teach a Class. And so I started off saying I have a no longer secret dream of one day teaching a class. And if I had a choice, it would be marketing strategy or math focused, because that's what I'm strong at. But then what I talk about is the format of how I would teach the class. And the way that I put it is I would actually do it on a blog is where I would host it. And for each class prior to it, I would actually post a video or maybe audio, but preferably do a video. That is the actual lecture itself. So that would last however long the class lasts. And their homework assignment would be to watch the video and take notes. And then if they had questions, and then it would be a comment section and maybe like use discuss or a forum or something like that. I thought maybe something like Friend Feed or maybe even Google Plus now that Friend Feed's dead would work, where they would be able to post comments, whether it's like, hey, good point, or they'd be able to post questions, and then you know you could have threaded responses underneath it, which I could respond, they could respond, whatever. And then the actual class time would be more like they would be meetups, if you will, a time to literally like ask more questions, to do their homework while I'm there trying to help them do it. It has a very much like a Khan Academy feel to it where they actually talk about like you do the lesson at home and then you do the homework in school so you can actually get help. And then the other thing, and the Bill Gates actually said it when I was writing this, is he said that he was like, it's kind of ridiculous that we're not already recording every single lecture because storage is cheap and the content is very valuable. And so that's where I would then, you know, the first year I'd be recording a bunch of stuff, but the second year I wouldn't. I would just repost the video and say, or say, I would, the homework assignment would be, look at this link, read, watch the video, read all the comments, then add to it if you have anything else to say above and beyond it. And it starts to build upon itself. And then I can spend my time either refining the videos, adding more content, answering questions, meeting with students, that kind of thing, doing research, whatever. But the idea is to create this, you know, this online place where students can come and ask questions and study together and figure out what they're doing. And something like this would be an awesome complement where, you know, yeah, I gave you a homework assignment. Maybe you're sitting in the middle of class and you're like, I don't know how to do this. And, you know, and you don't necessarily have to, like, raise your hand. You can literally type it in, hey, having trouble with this piece right here. Someone else in the class can go, oh, I know how to do that, and walk over and help them. Or yeah. Something like that. But
what's cool about – sorry.
I was just going to say, it's a really cool idea, and it's something that is woefully needed in universities.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Blackboard in concept is a good idea, but I think that, generally speaking, it's a horrible execution. And I completely agree. You know, in my programming classes, we use Google Groups and as our way of communicating, having class discussions, asking questions, setting up appointments and stuff. And I don't even know if West Valley uses Blackboard, but I know we wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole if it did. It's a good idea, poorly executed, and so it's cool to see another company come in and really say, "Hey, this is what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to bring this kind of communication to the forefront." And I still think that there's a lot of potential for open sourced versions of these kinds of projects. I think that that's where you might because I guess what my point is going to be is that anytime you have something, a mass market tool like this, it's either got to be one small part of the puzzle that it does really well, or it's just got to be a million and a half different things. Because one of the things that I think the problem with Blackboard was, is the requirement, it's kind of pigeonholed. It's designed for very specific things.
Right.
It doesn't execute it very well. And so if you don't fit into whatever it is that Blackboard wants you to do, it's way easier to just reject it completely. And so I think there's a real temptation, you know, in these sorts of things, is to make it look nice and give it, a nice shine. But if the usability doesn't give teachers flexibility, they're not going to be optimistic about using it. And I think, like you were saying with your MBA program, you know, one of the nice parts about having it be homegrown, even though it does, you know, sometimes result in clunkier UI, it's designed specifically for what the teachers need and want at the time. And
yeah, I remember, and this was like before texting was kind of a big deal. It was just at the forefront. I'm not that old. but there was a professor. He wanted to do like live quizzes where like you could ask a question and you all type in your answer. And or you know select ABC, and he wanted to do it for a series of questions and then look at the responses, and the guy was like, oh yeah, sure, let me whip that up. And it was like in 2 weeks he wrote this entire, pretty much like an add-in, think of it that way, and we were able to do it in class. And he just worked with him over the summer to get it the way that he wanted to, so that he could use it in the class. And he would just type in, you know, like what you'd expect, type in a question, do the answers, we would then see that, select the one we want, and then it made a little bar chart. Cool.
Nice.
And it was like, and it was that kind of thing, right? And that's one of the advantages of having the homegrown IT person. They can do those types of things. Blackboard, they would, you know, that would have been a joke.
Right. That would literally be impossible.
But I firmly believe that the education system, be it collegiate, primary, secondary school, is ripe for disruption and major change. I don't think 2012 is the year for it. I think you're going to continue to see the seeds being sown for it. But it's going to be companies like this. And I could definitely see a day, and I think I read this somewhere, so this isn't my idea, and I read it a long time ago, so don't look for a link on the website, where they said you could imagine a university of the future where they literally say, we have 300,000 students at this university, and they do almost exactly what I described, where they will go, we will find the best of the best professors in the land, and we will say to them, I will give you, man, I don't know, $300,000 per lecture.
Yeah.
Okay? And you go, make it awesome. And then yeah, you do this lecture, and you do a lecture series, and then you just charge students, I don't know, $2 per lecture. And so, you know, by the time they get done, it's like, how much did this class cost you? I don't know, how many lectures are there normally in a quarter semester? It's less than 25, right? Or maybe call it 25, whatever. So for the student, it costs them $50 for a class to get it from a top, the best professor in the world to teach this lecture.
Yeah.
And that is 300,000 students strong. So obviously you could do the math, right? He's making bank, very, very happy. He no longer has to do them other than literally do the updates. And then you can spend that other $300,000 hiring teacher aides, or, you know, whatever. You know, charge them $100 a class, whatever. It doesn't matter. The math's not important. You can then hire aides or teacher assistants to then meet and do online study groups with these different students, and they can all get together on these forums, and they can help each other, they can do the homework assignments, and you could really just like do immense learning. You could literally be the cheapest school in the world with the highest quality content in the world.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, you know, one of the cool experiments, you know, because I think sometimes, what am I trying to say? Let me collect my thoughts really quick. I think one of the things that people will be nervous about with this sort of a system is the fact that there is, you know, you're not going to be able to ask questions in class, or, you know, you're depersonalizing it. But I think it's important to bring up Khan Academy, especially, and we should probably link the TED Talk on Khan Academy.
Okay.
Because he lays it out so well. Essentially, in a lot of ways, that's one aspect of what they're doing. They have a fantastic lecture on a topic, and then, you know, you do some problems on it, and they kind of help you learn, and then they actually brought that into a classroom, and they did this sort of, you could track people's learning, how they learn, the rates at which they learn. You can have advanced students help slower students, and everybody increases, and because you're able to track all that data as a teacher, you're really able to help the people who need it and allow the people who don't need as much help to get ahead. And the thing that I thought was fascinating about what he pointed out was that what you always learned was that the slow students were the students that got hung up on one idea, but as soon as they had a breakthrough, they quickly caught up, and most students were in the same ballpark. The students that got left behind were literally the students that got left behind. They weren't necessarily less intelligent or less motivated or whatever you kind of you classically think of. Well, this explains why this student is not exceeding and this student is. It's no, they literally just got left behind.
Right.
And so that's, you know, there's so much you can do when you incorporate these sorts of technological advances into the classroom. And I think schools make a huge mistake by not having a club or a group of students that they either pay or, yeah, like I said, you know, help out or they're part of a club, but they homebrew these types of, get a couple of computer scientists, get a couple of computer engineers, make it a yearly thing that they help. And you might have to have one or two engineers on staff just so there's a consistency, but have this sort of a program be homebrewed for universities. And so you can really focus on developing awesome technologies, use modern HTML, use modern database stuff, build up huge, you know, really well-designed, useful things at home, and then you can open source this technology so you can share it with other schools. And, you know, because I think that there's a lot of development that still has to happen. There is not a magic bullet here because you're not talking about one problem that needs one technological solution and you're just trying to engineer the right solution. What you're trying to do is you're trying to meet a million different people's needs. And that takes a lot of time. And, you know, education has been evolving ever since we started educating people. So it's not something that we're going to... There's not a silver bullet, I guess, is my point. And so to have more people working on it, you know, more people working on the problem and making it more and more specific to different classrooms and sharing ideas, if you could start that movement and get people excited about doing that, I think you would just... It would be huge. It would be immense for your colleges, you know, and that would, you know, and those sorts of movements, I think, usually start on the collegiate level and then filter down to high schools and then eventually to middle and elementary schools. So that's cool. It's exciting. It's always fun to see this sort of stuff happen.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's definitely a start in the right direction. You're going to see all sorts of companies and solutions crop up, and it's going to happen. Especially with university tuition getting to what it is, they're going to have to figure out a way to save money, and this is part of that solution.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, nice part about something like this being, you know, not just you know, it's not just money saving, but it actually helps better educate people you're trying to give a great education to. So. All right, well, I got, I'm actually going to switch the order of these two articles, because one of these is short and just interesting. The other one I want to talk about a little bit more in the future.
All right.
So Apple released another patent this week, and I think it's a sweet idea. So you remember those Ionic fans?
Hold on a second. Can you try moving your mic a little bit? I'm getting a little pop, and I'm not sure if the rest of the world... But I just don't know if it got adjusted or not. But anyways, go ahead.
So do you remember those Ionic fans? They were, like, tall, and they would, like, clean out all of the dust and debris and dandruff of your house. Have any idea what I'm talking about?
No clue what you're talking about.
Okay. So, These things were all the rage a couple of years back, but they were called Ionic fans. They stand tall. They're not a traditional fan where they're circular. They're these little towers. They're usually, like, you know, between 3 and 6 inches across, usually about three feet tall. And what they have is they have these metal plates that they charge air on one end, giving it some sort of an ionic charge, and then on the other end, they reverse the charge, and so air literally just moves along those plates. And because it's all ionically charged, particles in the air get attracted to these metal sheets, air moves through, you actually create a wind current, and it cleans out the air.
Huh.
It doesn't use any filters, so you could pull them out, you could clean them off, and they cleaned off really well. Pretty neat technology. They're always wicked expensive, like $100 for a fan, so people didn't go out and buy them all the time. But they did keep air clean. They were one of the things that they were really known for is if you were a smoker, you'd bring one into your house because they actually could filter out a lot of the air.
Wow, interesting. Huh. Yeah,
nice part.
I am totally not in the loop on that technology.
That's funny. You obviously don't watch very many infomercials.
I do not.
So
and this isn't the one where they do the balloons through it, or is it?
No. That one's
different.
Actually, yeah, those are the guys that do the vacuum cleaners.
Okay.
And basically, that one, just so everybody knows, there's nothing magic about that except that they have really small, high-powered fans in the base that suck in air, and then they push air through that little circular halo thing, and what that does is it creates a low-pressure field on that side of the fan, which sucks a bunch of air through the opening, and that's how they get so much air moving through them. Actually kind of a neat idea.
I don't know that.
Yeah, that's and they're silent, or they're very quiet. You don't have to worry. These are also silent. So, anyways, my whole point in bringing this up was not to talk about a half-decade-old fan technology. the point of all of this was one of the things that happens with how those ionic fans work is you charge the air on one side and then you change the charge on the other side, and it essentially pulls the air through. You can direct the air based on where it's being charged, and so you don't have to have like rudders to move the air around. You can actually charge the air on the have a plate on the left of the passing air, and the air will bend to the left or do that to the right, whatever. You can direct air as it moves in. So Apple has patented what's essentially a cooling system for their computers, and if any of you have owned and Apple, you know that this is a problem that they constantly deal with. They're way more concerned about how good it looks and how quiet it is. They don't worry about heat issues as much as the mechanical engineer in me would like them to. And so what they basically developed is this idea that they'll have an ionic wind pump, so they'll push air into your computer, and then they'll have another number of sensors, so they'll actually be able to keep track of what is hot in your computer. Is it the battery? Is it the sound card? Is it the video card? Is it the whatever? And they'll keep track of all those sensors, and then they'll have a director that will be steady state. It'll just be charging plates.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and then they'll direct the wind within the air with the cooling air within your computer to cool down specific areas within your computer as it's being used. And so the huge advantage here is it's all steady state. Doesn't have any moving parts where some part will go bad and cause grinding noises. It's energy efficient because you're not cooling down the entire computer. You're just cooling down specific parts of the computer. And if it's anything like those ionic fans, it'll actually filter out dust and stuff as it goes into your computer, which is pretty cool.
Wow. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, so neat little patent. Hopefully we'll see that coming out in later this year as new computers come. Or this might just be defensive patenting that Apple sometimes does. But cool little piece of technology wanted to share with you guys. Hopefully we'll get to see that. And then my other Apple chunk of news is one of the things that everybody was concerned about when the iPhone 4S came out. Siri. So for those of you who don't know how Siri works, we've talked about it before, but I think it was before we had done the full go live thing, so you might have missed that podcast. I'll forgive you this time if you didn't listen to it. Essentially what Siri does is it takes a voice command, it does some pre-processing, but then it sends all that information to the iCloud, to Apple servers, where they actually do the heavy computation of trying to figure out what you said, what it means, what you want it to do. And at that point, it can send the information to Google, it can send the information to Wikipedia, it can send the information to Wolfram Alpha, or it can send it back to your computer, to your phone, with separate commands. And so, when you use Siri, it's kind of like making a voice over internet protocol phone call to Apple servers. And it turns out that that's data intensive. And
surprise. Yeah. I could have told you that.
Yeah. But well, I think
I guess maybe we didn't know how data intensive it was.
Right. So that's what's so terrifying about this to everybody all of a sudden is the thought was they're actually very small data packets, and they did a lot of studying early on to try to kind of predict if this was going to be a huge problem or not. Well, the iPhone 4S has been out there for a while. People have been using Siri, and it turns out that on average, people use twice as much data as on a 4S as they do the iPhone 4.
Nice.
So, they were already on, with just the 4, they were already starting to limit data usage. They were already trying to throttle some of the issues that have arisen from high data usage, and Apple introduced this awesome new technology that it turns out people love using. And you know, and people are using it like crazy. And because nobody, you know, with FaceTime, essentially how I understand these relationships to work, Apple comes up with the technology, and if it's going to use data, Apple has to go and talk to the telecoms beforehand and basically say, we're introducing this technology, can we turn it on right away or not? And so it's like with FaceTime, they build this technology, they build it so it can work over Wi-Fi, they build it so it can work over 3G, then they go to AT&T and they say, hey, we'd like to do this, can we do this? And AT&T says, no. You have no any idea how much data that will use? And so it doesn't get, it's not an initial release feature. The same thing with tethering, other stuff like that. Well, I think the assumption was with Siri, when they, you know, they actually sat down and talked with AT&T, because I'm sure they did, and Verizon and Sprint, the idea was that this isn't going to really increase data usage. And turns out that, you know, between faster data speeds and Siri, people are using their iPhone 4S like crazy, and it's really starting to choke up the data lines. And so essentially the reason I bring that article up is because people are finally sitting down and saying, Tim Cook is going to have to, this is going to be the first real fire that Tim Cook is going to have to deal with. Okay. Tim Cook has been CEO for a while. But mostly he's, you know, and he's been the active CEO for a long time, but they haven't had any real, you know, fires. The biggest thing that they've had to deal with was the battery issue, which we discussed, you know, on the 4S, which, you know, affected a really small population. And after the second release of iOS 5, they had fixed the problem for 99.9% of the cases. And so, what they're saying now is AT&T, or your major telecoms, especially in America, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, are going to have to do something, because this is going to cause a problem. This is really going to be,
So, are there a lot of people I just don't know yet that are hitting their data caps and, you know, where they never were before? And I don't know, there's a lot of different variables confounding it. You know, but is that the issue, that a ton of people are going to hit their data caps all of a sudden?
Well, this article does not actually say that. I don't think there's any data released on that, but what this article does talk about is the idea that the number of data hogs is quote unquote data hogs is really dramatically increasing. And so it's like And it's, you know, it's, what's this one saying? It's saying, there's, so it's like the top 1% of data users consume half of all traffic. So there's this really specific small part of the problem, and they consume a huge amount of traffic, but the problem is not necessarily them, it's the next 10%. That next 10%, they consume 90% of the rest of the traffic. So between those two, within the top 11% of users, you've got 95% of all data traffic is being used. And so that what's essentially happening is that 10% of heavy data user, or of not the ultra consumers, but just the heavy consumers, that 10%, they're starting to take even a bigger share of the pie. And they're getting introduced to technologies that are taking even bigger shares of the pie. Presumably, we've been talking about this, that Apple's going to open up Siri to third-party developers this year, if not next year. But at some point, Siri's not going to be all internal. People are going to start using Siri for way more than they've been using it for. So the question becomes, when that happens, what's that going to do to traffic? Well, it's going to increase even more. Obviously, Apple's pretty excited about this technology, but Google is wanting to do, you know, they're working on their own competitor, and if they do anything like Apple, they'll have a component of this, which is heavier data usage. And so this kind of all comes back to this idea of the telecoms really have a huge issue arising, and they're going to be looking to Tim Cook as CEO to figure this problem out or to help with it. It would usually go to Steve Jobs as the sort of guy that the captain of the ship that would go and deal with the other companies and kind of really do not the nuts and bolts, but the big picture. How are we going to make this work? And what everybody thought was going to happen with Siri, it's just way bigger. People weren't expecting it. And so this 10% that do, you know, 45% of all traffic, that is really growing. That's going to become an even bigger problem. So the question is, as this problem grows even more, you're going to be looking to somebody who can help, you know, see them through the storm. And there's not really anybody yet at the telecoms that are able to deal with that. So the question becomes, is it an engineering problem? Do you have to develop a better technology that uses less data, or is it a, you know, company problem where, you know, the telecoms have to deal with it? You know, I don't know. What do you think, James?
I wish I knew more about the technology, and, you know, and how it works. I'm sure there's lots of people who feel that way. I think that, man, I don't know. It sounds like they got some interesting solutions, putting more of those like Wi-Fi base stations that will take data off the network directly. Those will be, you know, helpful. Honestly, I don't see why they have to do the data plans that they do, where you pay for 2 gigs, you know, and they just hope that you don't go over it. I don't know why they can't charge you like a per kilobyte rate. I mean, they do that with power and water. And over time, you just learn that, oh, my bill is approximately this much. And so if you don't use a lot, you don't get charged a lot. If you use a lot, you do get charged a lot. I realize they got fixed costs, but, hey, so do power and water companies. So, you know, they've figured it out. I think that there's – at some point in time, they're fundamentally going to have to change their pricing strategy is what it comes down to. It is clearly not in alignment with the real world anymore. They used to get away with it when everyone, you know, used similar amounts, which was like nothing. But now that there's big differences, they're gonna have to figure it out a way, or you know, figure out ways to make their network more efficient, which it sounds like LTE could potentially be. I don't know how many years down the line that is. I think they're better off to figure out a more fair way to, you know, price their products.
Yeah.
And there will be 1 to 10% of the users who will absolutely hate it, but most people will like it. I wonder which group I'm in. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the scary part, isn't it? Well, I know which part I'm in. I'm in the 90% of humanity that uses 0% of the data.
Right. But yeah.
I want to be part of the 1%, so. I don't even know. I'm always amazed by that number, 1% consuming half of all traffic. Like, I really do wish there was more data on what they're doing. Especially with the advent of data caps and everything. Or is that really, are the caps actually, you know, relatively close to what, you know, what you would, I don't know. Are the caps still so grossly overestimating what the networks are capable of that, you know, 99% of people don't even use close to, you know, getting close to what they can use? I don't know. Does that make sense? I feel like I said a lot of words there and didn't necessarily come out as a sentence.
Yeah,
okay.
No, it's like, for example, when you use your printer and you get low on ink, you get a low ink warning. But you can still print a few pages. you're not out yet. There's a buffer there, and you know. So the question is, how much of a buffer is there? I don't know.
The other thing that you never even that I don't consider is I always assume we're talking about consumer grade usage, and when generally speaking, that's not necessarily the biggest use at all. It could be. Corporate uses that are using massive amounts of data, because suddenly they have the tools, the mobile tools that allow them to do what they want to do, but whatever they're doing requires a lot of data, and because it's a corporate office, they've got the money to spend on it. You know, it could be CEOs and guys, you know, managing massive databases and all sorts of crazy stuff. Who knows? But you know, I think that. Who knows? It'd be interesting to see what that actually is.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe someday.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I still think we're going to see a difference in pricing eventually, and that'll be what solves it. But
yeah, I agree.
We'll see.
All right, man. It's still so early in the year, I'd be willing to let you guess if it's going to be this year or not.
No, I am not going to guess on that.
Agree.
That's a tangled. That is a tangled web for sure.
Yeah, that has governments and users and Sony. That is the corporate opera at the extreme. It'll be fun to watch that one as it happens, because obviously we're building to a problem that we're not going to be able to engineer our way out of. I don't think. We're actually engineering an even messier problem by introducing cooler technology.
Yeah, totally.
Exciting. cool. So, I don't know, that was the last article I had. Got anything else?
So, did you do anything fun this weekend? No, you said you would do something this week.
Yeah, this week. So what's going on in my life? I decided a couple... months back, actually, when I was still working with Genentech, and I had a little bit of money, StarCraft II, Wings of Liberty, went on sale, so I bought it, and I played, like, a mission and was like, oh, that's fun, I'll have to do that again, and then I beat a couple more missions, and for anybody who knows me, I have not beat a video game, so I beat the first Portal, my junior year of college, which was, like, 4 years ago, and I beat Half-Life 2... my freshman year of college. Other than that, I've just, like, done sporadic playing of video games. I've watched people beat Halo. I've never actually beat the whole game myself. So this is one of the first video games in a long time but I actually played all the way through and I beat the game. It's a really cool storyline, and I'm kind of proud of myself. I know most people are like mocking me because I beat it on normal difficulty, but I'm feeling good about myself. And the thing I wanted to say was that, you know, I do think that video games are, you know, they're an important part of the tech industry, and we like to talk about the companies and what they're doing, but, you know, I think it's worth my time to get a little more invested time-wise on the actual games they're selling, and I am super impressed by the graphics engines of today. Once again, I feel like everybody's going to be laughing at me going, are you serious? But, like, you got to understand, StarCraft has always had great cutscenes. So they've got, like, one graphics engine that it's post-rendered CGI, so it's, you know, it's really high quality, looks awesome, there are these cool cutscenes. Then they got real-time CGI cutscenes, where it's like the actors have done everything, but it's all being rendered real-time, which is really impressive. And then they've actually got the game engine, where it's all 3D and it's being rendered real-time. So it's like, it's super impressive. And I thought it was a very enjoyable game. I recommend it to everybody, and hopefully they'll put Heart of the Swarm, the expansion pack, on sale for $30, you know, in a short period of time so that I can actually play that one as well. Because $60 is expensive.
yes it is. one of the reasons why I don't own an Xbox right now.
Yeah. You know, I've always thought that for a halfway decent movie, I don't feel like I wasted my money to go to a pretty good movie. And that gives me about 2 hours of entertainment, costs about $10, so about $5 per hour. So for a video game paying $60, I expected the bare minimum. What is that? Jeez. That's only 6 hours. Sorry, 18 hours of solid gaming time. Which I think this game had 25 missions, and I beat every mission, and they all took about an hour, so I came in, I actually only paid $30 for it, so I thought it was a good deal. $60, you're kind of pushing it, because that's six movies I could have gone to. I don't know, but yeah, the cost issue is a problem. So.
Yeah, you just need to get a job. That will help with that.
Exactly. So, what about you? You do anything fun?
I played with the Kindle Fire.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That was my fun.
Damn.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
very
awesome.
Cool. Well, good conversation. Good stuff. Next week is CES, and so we'll make sure to follow all the cool stuff and report back on our opinions on what's cool, what's not cool, and, you know, what has a future, and most likely what doesn't. And yeah, we'll definitely have thoughts about that. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. I am James Furlow, and my brother is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time. Thank you.